The opinions expressed by guests on Rathbones Inspired Minds are personal and will not necessarily reflect the views of Rathbones Investment Management, nor will they constitute a recommendation or advice to buy or sell any product or service on behalf of Rathbones Group PLC.
The Rathbones Inspired Minds podcast series.
Hello and welcome to the Rathbones Inspired Minds podcast series. I'm Daniel Norcross. In each episode, acclaimed writers, scientists and entrepreneurs reveal what inspires them. Today, I'm delighted to be joined by a woman who has had a long and varied career. She co-founded feminist magazine Spare Rib in 1972 before becoming a director of Virago Press. She would go on to edit Esquire magazine, The Independent, Independent on Sunday and Daily Express, becoming the first woman to hold the top job of a UK daily newspaper. After leaving The Express in 2001, she went on to advise the government on food strategy, and in 2018, she was nominated for a life peerage by the House of Lords Appointment Commission and now sits as a crossbencher. Welcome to Inspired Minds, Baroness Rosie Boycott.
Good morning.
Now, Rosie, we begin every single one of these by asking about inspiration. That's the hook. That's what it's all about. But what, if anything, do you think are the things that inspire you most? And how important is inspiration in your journey through the various different and varied parts of your career?
Well, inspiration is everything in a way, isn't it? It's like hope, but hope is slightly formless unless you have something that you can articulate the hope around. And in a way, that becomes the inspiration because you have glimpsed or seen some possibility that you think is better. I suppose that's basically how I see it, is that since I was very young, and when I was 16, I was handing out copies of the Internationale outside Woolworths in Ludlow. Not a great profession, I can tell you, but I'd saved up my pocket money because I could see that there was an inspiration about what I would call the fairer world. I mean, little did you know at that time, but, you know, this is the 1960s and people still thought that Marxist-Leninism and indeed Maoism were the ways to run the world. So you had inspirational ideas on which you could try to mould your own, and they gave you directions of travel. And later on in life, obviously, there were a lot of individuals that inspired me. And I think individuals, in a way, are much more important than political belief systems. Certainly when we started the magazine Spare Rib, I had many individuals who I greatly admired, and they were different kinds of people. I mean, there were women writers, there were women journalists, they were women who just seemed to be able to work against the odds and still be, such a planned word to say, but still be nice. That, you know, there was a long time of feeling that women would always support women. It was incredibly inspiring, the early days of feminism, because people really not talked about it. People never talked about sex. People never talked about abortions. People on the whole didn't talk about rubbish marriages, didn't talk about the pressures of being the stay-at-home mum and what that felt. And so we used to, in groups, get together and we would help inspire each other by articulating and being able to see different futures for ourselves. So I think that if you don't have inspiration, I'm not quite sure how you get off the back foot, because where would you go, quite frankly? You'd just be sort of blundering along in the dark. But I do believe it comes in many different forms and shapes and sizes, and that you can be massively inspired, as I say, by a poem, by a piece of art, by a person, or indeed by a situation you see that you really, really don't like. So it's a kind of counter-inspiration, in that I chair something now called Feeding Britain. And whenever I go and visit one of our social supermarkets, and, you know, for instance, the other day we were in the Wirral, and we have a very, it's funny applying words like successful to things like this, but successful in that we now employ 5 people and we have about 200 members and we have a full-time chef and she bakes, and people can come in who are not using the supermarket and they can buy food and bread, and all of that ticks over to make the thing economically viable. And then if you are on certain levels of universal credit, you can access the supermarket, and we give out free breakfast to everybody who's homeless in the area. So it does all sorts of magnificent things. And then we decided that one of the ways to try to get people off loan sharks was to work with the credit union to try to set up very tiny bank accounts so that you could establish a credit. And the starting price for the bank account was £10, and that would get you on a ladder. And not one of our members had £10. And that was very, very shocking to me. It is one of those illustrations that tells you so much about the country we live in and the sort of things we need to do. But I find that also extremely inspiring, that you think, yes, I kind of know why I do things now. And every so often you come up against that and you think, yep, okay, this is the reason why I get out of bed in the morning often. It's because there's not one person in that place who had 10 quid. And in fact, as a charity, we do rather well for people giving us money. I mean, the lottery give us money and Comic Relief give us money. And, you know, we do what we say on the tin. So we paid for 50 people to get going on a bank account, but it still didn't change the feeling of being in the nose. Sorry, it's a complete ramble.
It's not a ramble at all. I mean, a couple of things that instantly jump out to me is that there may be a kind of an angry inspiration and there may be a positive inspiration. Now, they can be adjacent to each other. I'm sort of interested in how they manifest. And over the course of your life, it seems to me that you were probably inspired by injustice, inequality, infuriation at that, and you've articulated an example of that here. But you've also described being inspired by individuals who may have given, I don't know, I don't want to call it a more positive inspiration. It just comes in a different way. Are you able, when looking back at a varied career, to say which of those has ended up with a more successful outcome? By which I mean, you know, sometimes I get very infuriated by something and that inspires me to do something about it. I often find that it doesn't work for me in that sense because the anger is almost a roadblock to progress.
Yeah, that's a really interesting question, whether anger can be a roadblock to progress. And I think it is all too often for people. And I think, in fact, anger with nowhere to go is an incredibly dangerous thing to have floating around in a society, because then you end up angry with yourself and angry with the world. And I think a lot of people really do suffer from that. And I feel quite lucky that I've always had ideas about how to do practical applications to various problems. But I do not take on the problems of the entire world, so I choose not to. But in terms of, say, positive inspirations, when I was founding Spare Rib, we had a very clear image of what we wanted to achieve. And that was that women had an equality with men. And that I remember when we wrote the first ever editorial for Spare Rib, nobody really believes this now because things divided so much. But we, you know, we said liberation is as much for men as it is for women. It's just as much of a trap to be a man getting married at 20 years old and you work till you're 65 and then you're chucked out and retired. And in that time, you've been solely responsible for your wife and your 2.2 children and you've had 2 weeks holiday and it's complete trap in the way that the trap is right. Now, that I find very interesting to look back on, because for a little time probably being a few months, we were very passionate that we could somehow pioneer a revolution that took both people along. It quickly became apparent that, of course, you couldn't do anything of the sort, or we couldn't, because the cause of what was happening to women was so huge. But it was an interesting naivety that we believed that you could change life for women. And women's lives have changed. I mean, massively. I know there's lots of things that I can give you a list along my arm, things that I still find terrible, mostly childcare, if I could solve that. But lives for men have not changed anything like so much. And there hasn't been the same concentration. And I think, you know, you see the rise of the incel groups. And I find that very scary. And then every so often, a young woman comes along and completely blows me away. So my recent blow away has been a young woman called Sema Gornal. And Sema's mother was taken as a slave on the Kurdish-Turkish border when she was 9. She was kidnapped to Cyprus. She was repeatedly raped. She had her first pregnancy when she was 13. She finally had Sema when she was 15 and Sema's sister. Sema managed to get herself through this extraordinary situation. She got a degree at Oxford. She now runs a charity called Genders, which is about stopping female genital mutilation. She is very inspiring to me as to what a person can do with the difficult circumstances. You know, some people can be crippled by anger and some people just be empowered. She just became a British citizen and she's an amazing woman. She makes your heart lift because you think, yes, this is a problem. Someone's seen the solution. My generation can get behind this woman and help. We couldn't do it, but we can help her across some of these lines. And I find that completely wonderful thing to be able to do. And so, you know, she has been one of the people who has inspired me a lot. I mean, I also have lots of very young environment activists who, again, are incredibly inspiring because they really put their freedoms, in the sense that they might get arrested, on the lines to march for what they believe in. And I think that you don't do that unless you believe you can make it work. You don't do it. And that hinges on being inspired to believe in your ability to change and in the group of people around you, the ability to affect change and make it happen. It's hard making change happen. It's really hard.
You have been involved in movements of change from the 70s onwards, the feminist movement, and you have said we've seen enormous change. We saw enormous change happening in the 80s when Ken Livingstone introduced proposals in the early 80s that we now think of as being completely benign about lesbian and gay community. Arguments seem to get won almost without us noticing, and yet they require a movement to make them happen. When you reflect back on all that period of time, does that give you at least a positive glow about what can be achieved? And yet at the same time, we always seem to be on the precipice of frustration with whatever it is we're trying to get to change, rather than accepting that it's going to be a process that's going to take quite a long time.
Well, yes. I'm trying to think quite how to answer that. So,
well, as a journalist,
very, very little. And when I was 20, 21, we were starting this experiment, I naively thought that you could flick switches and make everything change. That all you really had to do at that point was pass Equal Pay Act, open university doors to women to be doctors and accountants and whatever they wanted to be. I mean, legally, you could do a whole bunch of things. And that's wrong, because you can legislate certain things, but you cannot culturally make them stick and make them be part of the everyday discourse until they have had time to bed in through people. And many of these things, as I say, some of them have never really bedded in. Many things have been a great surprise to me. I, for instance, thought that women would never wear makeup again. I mean, how wrong could you be? And yet the cultural significance of changes that affect people and family structures and the way that men and women relate are equally, and in some cases almost more important than some of the law. So if you take a thing like gay marriage, you had to have many cultural years before that. And then at a certain moment, it goes snap. But you would not have got the snap without the movement of culture and without enough people normalizing something and making people, on the whole, it's about making people unafraid. It's about making people feel that it is just okay for everyone to do it. I mean, in America, the campaign for gay marriage was extremely interesting because a bunch of people got together and they paid a very, very high-powered American firm who concentrated on behavior change. They gave them a 10-year campaign and a massive budget to say, we want at the end of this to people just think it's normal. And they did another clever thing, which they looked at how would we attempt to sell this to people. And you could sell it on, oh my gosh, it's human rights, oh, it's kind of fairness, oh, it's political. But in fact, what they settled on was every American has a right to a family life. And you find yourself coalescing around an absolutely fundamental principle that doesn't matter where you stand politically, you cannot dispute it. And it passed very easily. And there are so many different ways, as well, I suppose I'm trying to say, that things pass. I mean, I work now, not exclusive. I mean, I do food politics and I do environment politics. And I now am coming up to 20 years of doing food politics. And I can say that actually the reality is worse, despite all the food politics I've done. But that does not make me stop trying to do it. And it does not make me feeling hopeful, because there will be a point, it's a bit like saying with gay marriage or something, a point at which you hope you've got enough people who will say, actually, this food system is abnormal, and therefore we want a better food system, a more normal food system that protects the health of us and particularly our children and particularly our planet. So you work around in the background, often making no progress. I mean, say the ill health from ill food, stats still going up, obesity stats still going up, biodiversity stats, BAP stats still going up. Deforestation getting a bit better, but not gone at all yet. You know, so it's very, very far away from there, but you have to spread. And I guess, you know, feminism was the same. You had to spread it very thin and then very thick until it became part of the culture. I wrote a book when I was 31 about my years in my 20s and a lot of things. And then now I think if I write this again, I'll see this completely differently. You know, you start to see a long passage of time where certain things happened quite fast, but a lot of things happened extremely slowly, and some things didn't happen at all.
There seems to be like a slight difference in environmentalism, certainly, and the feminist movement and gay rights, because one is about ideas that you want to win. You want to win the argument of ideas of fairness and equality. If you don't win those arguments swiftly, then just cruelty continues. And I know that sounds glib, but it is just cruelty and unfairness goes on. Whereas with environmentalism, we're encouraged to believe that this is an urgent issue, that without solving it very shortly, we're going to have environmental catastrophes that are going to make things worse and worse and worse. So actually, in a strange sort of way, that puts a very different pressure, doesn't it, on how you win the battle of ideas? Because obviously, you were desperate to win the battle around feminism and around gay rights. But if you don't, what happens is that just cruelty persists. Whereas if we don't win the argument about environmentalism, the world boils. So how do you structure conversations around that without frightening people off?
Well, that's the kind of million-dollar question, although we probably ought to now call it a billion-dollar question, which no one is very good at the moment at dealing with, especially here. And I think there are a lot of very scary things happen in the disregard for science by politics. I find that very frightening. The disregard for science by people like Trump.
Is that a more modern phenomenon? I mean, you were writing throughout the 70s and 80s. You were dealing with politicians. Now, you're not a politician as such, but as a baroness, you sit in the House of Lords, sit with legislators. Do you see this playing out far more urgently, far more obviously as well, this disregard for science?
I think the thing is that now we have all sorts of documents that will reveal that companies that did a tremendous amount of research in the 70s, they absolutely predicted every single thing that's happened. They knew it and they decided to bury it. And it is about a greed and a capitalism and a short-termism and something that is very peculiarly human that I'm not sure that any of us really quite understand, which seems to be a streak of selfishness that is quite gargantuan, because you look at, say, some of the big tech billionaires and they're all busy buying large chunks of New Zealand or large chunks of Montana in which to hide away. They do not give their children mobile phones. They know that a lot of the technology and a lot of the stuff they're doing is having this terrible effect. And yet, this is an issue that is genuinely global, and we have still a good chance of averting this catastrophe. But we're not going to get away scot-free here, because the rise in temperatures will almost certainly going to hit 2 degrees in places this year, and there will carry on being catastrophic floods. And it is extraordinary right now. For instance, can't buy any new potatoes this year. I know this sounds middle class and ridiculous, but I love new potatoes. And I was in talking to a greengrocer on Saturday. They've all been flooded out. They've never not been able to get new potatoes before from Cornwall and Jersey. They can't plant any new ones. The weather's too difficult. And there's an immensely interesting process of human denial going on right now, because actually people aren't saying we haven't got the new potatoes because the changed weather systems are from climate change. They're saying we've had all these floods, and then the sentence kind of stops. And I can't work out whether it's fear. The politicians do not like to take on anything that they can't resolve. And the truth is, no one on their own can resolve this issue. And they lie a lot. I mean, when the ministers stand up in the Lords and say Britain has reduced its carbon emissions more than any other developed country, on one level, that's true. But what we've also done is we've shut down all our manufacturing, pretty much. And we've outsourced everything to China. I mean, where I'm sitting, I would say pretty much everything in this room has been through China. Maybe not my wallpaper, but we don't pay for those emissions. They're not on our bill. They're on China's bill. So there is a kind of mockery and a deceit at the heart of everyone's environmental campaigning. Yes, I find it very worrying. I mean, I've just got grandchildren. They're 18 months old, and I realise they'll be alive in the next century. And, you know, I have a normal, which was growing up in the 50s, and my dad was, for instance, an incredibly keen birdwatcher, and every year Dad and I would go looking for birds' eggs. We did still take a few, not many, but over my dad's life he'd collected a lot. But we could lie down under a hedge and kind of guarantee we'd see three or four birds' nests one way or another. Lie down under the same hedge, nothing. So your normals, your ideas of what your nature base is, are drifting away from people. And on my good days, I think, yeah, you know, okay, maybe the world will come together and sort this one out. On my bad days, I think it's going to take more catastrophe before there is a real sense of change. And I think it's really frightening. And I'm also part of the tribe that slightly puts my head down sometimes and tries to work on the things that I think I could have a part in solving, like stopping oil and gas sea licenses, bang, increasing wind power, insulation to buildings, stopping British finance going into deforestation, working with pension funds to disinvest from oil and coal, to all these different things that you can do, but they're small and everything depends on China. And a huge amount is going to depend on the American election because, for instance, apparently last weekend before last, Donald Trump had all the big oil companies to Mar-a-Lago and sort of promised them the sky if they gave him $1 billion. And I sort of think they did, although I can't actually accurately find out. So I think this is a very scary moment. And we've had many, but this I find very scary.
When I hear you talking about environmentalism in this way, when you're making spare rib and when you were becoming the first woman to be the editor of a daily newspaper, I think I read you say somewhere that a headline in the Daily Express could influence government policy in a day. And this is such a totally different mindset that you're in throughout this whole period of your life, I'm imagining, from where you are now, where you can't change government policy in a day. You have to change government policy bit by slow, grinding bit. When you look back on the earlier Rosie Boycott, did you ever think that she would have the patience to enter into this kind of process after the process that you had basically made your life's work before?
Oh, well, I mean, I'm older. That's one thing. And let's talk about some of the policies. The Mail's power is still quite extraordinary. With the Express, for instance, there was one day with the Express, and we had a lot of elderly people who read the Express, a lot of pensioners, and they increased the weekly pension. For some absurd reason, it was increased by 67 pence. And there was an outcry. And someone in the office, who was a very quick thinker, said 67p is the price of a packet of peanuts. And we went and got one of those blue KP peanuts bags and emptied it out, scratched it, and then we just photographed it and broke peanuts and put it on the front page and carted it down to Downing Street. And then by lunchtime, they put the pension rate up. So there are certain kind of weird knee-jerk things that you could do. You could raise a lot of money, very humbling money for refugees, for famines, for crises. We could wage cases about individuals who were facing immigration status. I mean, there was a huge amount you could do around that. The Mail also can and does exert an extraordinary power over what governments do. I keep waiting for the day when social media in some way starts to overtake the power of the Daily Mail, but it hasn't happened yet. The answer to a question you haven't quite asked, but if the question was, are there days you wish you were back running a daily newspaper? The answer is yes. Frequently, there are things that you think, oh my God, if I could add voice to that loud, clear and shouty, I'd want to do it because it is a voice that kind of cuts through in ways that are, I think, peculiarly British because of the stranglehold that the media has had and also the long, 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 long-term connections that the media's had to the establishment. And the media itself has become a very, now, in the last, like, 25 years, a very curious kind of beast because when my first husband worked on the Sunday Times and he was on the Insight team, and that was the investigative journalist team, they were all very highly paid. They were very loved. They were taken care of by the great Harry Evans. He kind of gave them a room. He didn't give them any pressure. David, my first husband, with a couple of colleagues, they did the Kim Philby thing. They did the thalidomide investigations. They did things that took weeks, were great, wonderful, historic acts of journalism. And the journalists were the best paid people on the newspapers. And then a sort of curious phenomenon happened. The moment that news became 24 hours, and the moment the internet began to become a source of information and news, you realize that you do not ever get news from a paper. You never get news from the front page. You already know the story. You heard it hours before by one means or another. So there was this curious switch that happened, and that the thing that the newspaper could own was the voice and the columnist. And the newspapers became way more opinionated through the 90s and into the early 2000s. And they became much more rampantly political. I mean, I own the Express. You know, the Express for many years was the biggest newspaper in the world. It sold 6.5 million copies a day for a long time. I mean, it made unbelievable amounts of money. But it was a very newspaper. I mean, it was extremely brilliant. And it told you stuff about everything in the world that you could think you might want to know. And you know, these big pages, and they were filled with lots and lots and lots of stories. They had enormous quantities of staff. But then later, when you look at them now, they are about opinion more than they're about news. So every news story, there's an angle. I mean, boat sinks in Channel. You don't actually get that. You get horrible migrants sink in Channel, poor migrants sink in Channel. You know, everything's opinionated. So they've somehow got this big stranglehold on politicians, which also has, I'm afraid, much too much power.
Someone described this to me as how there used to be news and now there's feelings, as he would describe it.
Yeah, completely. There's feelings. You buy opinion. And the highest paid people on newspapers now are the columnists, by a long, 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 long way. Much more than the news gatherers. So it's like, it's great when you have a journalist like Amelia Gentleman cracking Windrush, because no one else is going to do it.
So when you were an editor, you know, I think we've sort of slightly skirted over the fact that you were the first woman editor of a daily newspaper. There will obviously have been challenges involved in that. But you were still at a time, were you, when it was about gathering news, about disseminating news, and that was primary? Or were you in that sort of the cuspy moment where things were changing?
Yeah, and we were paying a lot for the columnists, yes. You know, news came with attitude. It wasn't straight. There has been a bomb. It would not be straight. It would have to be, it would be outrage. It would be a bomb by who, a bomb by that. It would have, you'd start to have this feeling. And I went, before the Express, I'd edited the Independent and the Independent on Sunday. And, you know, people think that news is the same, but in fact, it's not. I mean, if you are an independent journalist or a Guardian journalist, you go to an event and you'll ask different questions from the guy who's gone from the Telegraph. So the question of unbiased news is, in fact, extremely difficult to get your hands on, unless you were there. And yes, of course, you can establish a certain amount of facts, but so much of it is interpretation. And the fact that we have programs like GB News, and that there's a lot of polarization of the way we think about things, and actually coming back to climate change, that falls resolutely in the middle of it. I mean, it wasn't until that long ago that if the BBC had a heavy-duty climate scientists with degrees as long as your arm, they would produce Nigel Lawson to put the opposite view. And you think, what planet are we on here? There isn't an opposite view. You can't say that the place is not getting hotter. And he would say it's not getting hotter. He would say it's because we've got this wind, or because we're in this kind of cycle, which 99% of the scientific community had all disproved. And the 1% who would be wobbling, if you had taken half a second to look, you'd find that they were in the pay of the fossil fuel companies, because smoking and fossil fuels, and indeed now food, is one of their methods of doing things, is to flood the report writers with grants and with money. And I mean, I've been doing an inquiry in the Lords on ultra-processed food, and Chris Van Tulleken, who I don't know if you follow, but Chris's book is paperback on the bestseller list. And if you read in the paperback about what happened after the book came out, you know, so he gets phone calls and someone says, well, I pay you £20,000 to come give a half-hour talk. And he thinks, oh, that's nice, I'll give it to my charity. And then he sees the contract, and the contract says, you can't mention our product. You can't mention that we produce anything bad. But companies like Nestle, 68% of what they produce is actually categorized as unhealthy. And yet governments have very little. I mean, this makes me depressed. Why are governments so pathetic? Why can't they just stamp down?
I don't know. I mean,
they are, honestly, they're really woeful. All the economic evidence is now in about what this has cost us, what's going to cost us long term. I mean, I have a naive belief that if you could fix the food system, you'd fix the world, because it is responsible for so many things that go wrong and so much unfairness and ill health, and the massive, massive loss of biodiversity due to the way we farm is, well, just terrible.
When did this sort of come front and centre in your mind? I mean, obviously, it's well documented that you went and started a small holding in Somerset. And a lot of people have said they found it really bizarre. You know, Rosie Boycott, firebrand journalist, very urban, you have a very urban feel, you know, constantly appearing on the Late Review and this, that and the other. Off you go into a small holding. But you did say something earlier in this chat we've just had about your dad and birds and eggs and being out in the countryside. So you presumably had a bit of a grounding in the bucolic, shall we say, before you went to Somerset.
Well, yes, that is true. But it's also not the only reason. I mean, I'd come off editing The Express. I mean, things had not gone well. I'd got drunk. I'd crashed my car. I nearly lost my leg. I was on crutches for 20 months. I thought life was only going to go one direction, which was down. And we rented this cottage in Somerset, and then we acquired the walled garden, and we gardened away. And we then decided that it would be interesting to see if you could make yourself self-sufficient and sell and entertain. And I started writing a book about it. So I started researching, and I became obsessed. I became more and more fascinated by this subject that was all around you and essential to you, but that I'd never really questioned in my life at all. I mean, how did food get from A to B? What did food do? How did we farm? And it had the kinds of villains that I like, you know, which is nine giant companies that effectively own the world that nobody knows anything about, who can pull any strings and cut down rainforests, and animal welfare. I mean, you know, we all have eight animals in a cage somewhere for each person on this planet. There are 80 billion caged animals waiting to feed us. I mean, it's truly shocking what goes on. And it also contributes a lot to climate change. It now contributes hugely to, it is the biggest driver of ill health, of preventable ill health, is the bad food system. And so it is a issue of everything that kind of motivates me. I mean, it's inequalities, it's unfairness, it's gross wealth, it's destroying countryside and nature and destroying kids' futures. So it's quite a kind of potent combination. I like the world of the people who try to. They're very good news.
So before you actually set up the small holding, though, do you feel you had to actually live the experience of making the food, understanding the difficulty of that, and then understanding the economics of it, understanding, you know, how much you get paid for that? Is it right that you produce 750 eggs and you got paid £80 for it? And I know this was quite some time ago. I mean, that suddenly puts into stark relief.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I learned everything I could about it. And indeed, I continue to learn about it every day. Something new I find. It's one of those weird things that people don't take responsibility for it. And these giant companies, they will cut down rainforests where they will rear pigs. Pigs effluent and everything gets discharged into the rivers. And then the pigs, when they're slaughtered, get sent to China. So there's a real sense in some really big, massive companies that just kind of exploit the world. And after the war, it was fair enough to say you have to grow a lot of food. So a lot of farming institutions were brought into being, which do with different kinds of wheat that grow very fast, different pesticides, insecticides, lots of explosive stuff left after the war to create fertilizers. And the Green Revolution, as it was then called, was miraculous, but it had, like practically everything, had a huge payback. And it wasn't until not that long ago that people started to understand that if you ploughed the soil, which if you think about the soil, and I like this as a way to think about it, it is a miracle of miniature. It's like a miniature town, a miniature city, a miniature cathedral going on under your feet. And hundreds of millions of critters live down there, and they have their homes and their livelihoods, and they attach themselves to roots, and they move food around, and they're busy. And then if you deep plough every 6 months or so, you're in Gaza and someone's come straight through and crashed through your home. And so eventually the soil dies, it becomes very weak, it becomes very dry. In order to make it grow, you put on more pesticides and you put on more fertilizers in order to reboot the soil. So the whole thing becomes a very, very destructive system, and was why we get bad flooding, because the topsoil has been washed off because the rain's taken away because there's no means of holding it together. And everything has an unintended consequence. But I mean, you can actually see why soil went bad. But the scary stuff about a lot of the modern technological ideas, again, about, you know, can you cloud seed? Can you put carpets under the Antarctic? Can you put carbon capture and storage and stuff it back underneath the North Sea? These are all theories. They're untested. And there's sort of not really anything that's been done in this scale or this way that hasn't come back and bitten us and had a very bad unintended consequence.
It seems to me that you may have devoted quite a lot of your journalistic life to sort of specific news stories, and they would have big ideas attached behind them, and indeed starting off with spare rib and feminism. But you've almost opened up a whole can of worms, which is everything. I mean, the food system is basically everything.
Yes.
What I'd like to end with, really, is to understand how temperamentally you cope with that. Because, you know, as one gets older, you might think that there is a greater urgency to get things done. Because, you know, just the natural entropic process, the human condition. And yet, where you seem to have gone is away from the specific and now into the absolutely macro, which is a huge undertaking. Do you reflect on that at all? And do you find it soothing? Do you find it energizing? Do you find it inspiring? I'm sort of fascinated by that.
Well, it's always inspiring because there's so many people out there who are so near to being able to fix it that I sort of feel if we could get to the right tipping point, there are enough people who would be able to pick it up and do it right or do it better. It's frustrating, but, you know, there's lots of things that are. So you just, I'm quite good at living day to day. That's probably because I'm alcoholic. I mean, I've been in fellowships for many, many, many years, and I think about the day more than I think about the rest, and I think I can do this and that and the other. And things like Feeding Britain give me huge joy because I think we do something that fits in, that straddles the misery of the food bank and the kind of misery of Tesco's at the same time, gets in the middle. And I do quite a lot of other charities too that I think help. You can only do what you can. I still hang on to a belief, though, that if you could turn the food system round 100%, you would kind of turn the world round. As I get older, I get more upset about sick animals. I can't really quite work it out in myself. But if I watch some of David Attenborough's stuff about animals in real trouble, like that thing about the flamingos in Chile, I'm hysterical. And I get more hysterical about that. And it's a strange thing of age. I think maybe you feel you can't cry enough for all of humanity, but you can cry a bit for animals and the defencelessness of it. And, you know, humanity's brought this one on ourselves, but the animals certainly didn't. So I don't actually know what I'd do with myself if I didn't try. I just don't know what I'd do. I do pottery. I go cold water swimming, both of which I enjoy very much, but it wouldn't keep me going.
So the notion of retirement, whatever that may mean, is just entirely anathema to you?
Yeah, actually. I love work. I love having colleagues. I love working on amendments. I love it when you get something to stick. I love the fact that you think I put a little brick in a wall. I suppose that's what I think now. It's all about bricks in walls, hopefully one day having the wall big enough and solid enough that they can't knock it over. And if you can help get one in, that's okay.
Well, that is an inspiring note on which to leave it. Baroness Rosie Boycott, thank you so much for being on Inspired Minds.
Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to the latest episode of the Rathbones Inspired Minds podcast series with me, Daniel Norcross, and my fabulous guest, Baroness Rosie Boycott. You can listen to previous episodes of the series on all major podcast platforms. And if you enjoyed listening, don't forget to like or subscribe. To find out more about the series, just go to rathbones.com.
The Rathbones Inspired Minds podcast series, now available on all podcast platforms and at rathbones.com.